I'll call the Alaska Energy Authority board meeting of October 29th to order.
Oh, hang on. We got to unmute. Sorry. Let's try that again. There you go.
Okay, I'll call the October 29th regular meeting of the Alaska Energy Authority board to order. Roll call, please.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy? Okay, she's absent. Mr. Smith?
Present.
Mr. Mathiason?
Present.
Mr. Seedman? He's absent. Mr. Izzo?
Present.
Mr. Mitchell?
Present.
Mr. Copeland?
Present.
You have a quorum, Chair. Fine.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make a motion.
This is Duff Mitchell. I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
Tony Izzo, second.
Second here, Mathiason.
Okay, thank you. Any additions, modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the agenda as submitted, roll call, please.
Okay, Commissioner Sandy, absent. Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiason? Mr. Mathiason, would you like to approve the agenda?
Yes.
Mr. Seedman is absent. Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
And Chair Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, thank you. I said the regular meeting of October 29th. It's actually the 30th. That's some Cordova jet lag, I guess. Okay, approval of the prior minutes of July 10th. I'd just like to make one modification. I think Mr. Mitchell we had listed as absent, and we had discussed ahead of time he had a work-related conflict, and if we can just reflect that that's excused absence.
Yes, sir. No, we'll take care of it.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
And it doesn't really specify that in the bylaws, but I think that was a consensus. So.
Tony Izzo moved to approve as submitted with the change.
Do we have a second?
Clewell and Smythe seconded.
Do you have a motion, a second, to approve the amendments of July 10th? Any additions, deletions, or corrections other than the one noted? Okay, hearing none, roll call vote.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiason?
Yes.
Mr. Seedman is absent. Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
And Chair Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, public comments. I'll just mention that members of the public who wish to provide written comments can please email your comments to publiccomment@akenergyauthority.org the day before the meeting, so that window's passed. And on the meeting day, any callers can enter the teleconference muted, and we'll ask the callers to press star 9 on their phones if you wish to make public comment. So I'd like to open the meeting for public comment at this time. Is there anybody in the room who would like to make public comment? Do we have anybody online?
Is there anybody on the phone that would like to make a public comment? Please press star 9 and you'll be recognized. Okay, no public comments, Chair.
Okay, thank you. So, presentation of the Alaska Energy Authority draft financials. I'll turn it over to Director Thayer.
All right. Thank you very much. What was sent out on Friday was our draft financials, and what we would like to invite is BDO and Vicki up here, and Pam, if there's any questions, considering our audit that we are currently wrapping up. We have not done the single audit, and Vicki will mention why that has not been completed yet. And with that, I'll turn it over to our auditors to discuss our financials.
Good morning, Board of Directors. My name is Vicki Sresta. I am one of the auditors from BDO right here in town. First of all, I'd just like to start by thanking everybody that helps us get all the information, especially Pam and our team, to get all the information put together so we can get this wrapped up pretty fast. The way all the audit works, way she can get all the information, it doesn't get completed until like middle of August, almost September. So we turn it around pretty fast once we get all the information to get the audit done. Few things for this year. I just would like to let you know that we are substantially completed for the audit, the financial statement audit we're planning on issuing tomorrow. We won't be issuing the federal single audit yet this year. When we audit federal programs, we have to follow uniform guidance, and there is a compliance supplement that's provided by the OMB that we follow. That compliance supplement for 2025 is not finalized yet, so there was a draft version, and we audited all the programs based on the draft version. So just to let you know, as far as the single audit or the federal single audit goes, we have actually completed majority of the work, but we're still finishing up some items in there, but then we won't be able to actually release that single audit until that compliance supplement is finalized. So when that's going to be finalized, we have no idea. Normally, the compliance supplement is finalized March, April, and the latest I've seen is like June of the year, but this year it's still not finalized. So that's one little difference this year. So that part is not done, but everything that you need for your reporting, for your bond compliance and everything, those will be done as of tomorrow. And then as far as the wrap-up goes, I think this presentation didn't make it to you, but this can be provided right after the meeting. But I can point out a few things on the wrap-up that we as auditors have to communicate to you So first of all, just the overview and the status of the audit. As I just said, we have substantially completed the work. Just to remember that the objective of an audit is to obtain reasonable but not absolute assurance about whether the financial statements are free from material misstatements. It just means that an audit is not designed to look at each and everything that goes through your financial statements. We follow our risk assessment.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but the version that I have is blank on every page. I just have the first page.
The version of apology
that you sent me is just one page.
The version of
it says it's 22 pages, and the first four pages are
that can be supplied after the I don't know why I didn't.
Let me forward.
Okay, we can get that to you. Okay. I printed it out just before the meeting.
Can we get the
I'll send it to Leanne. Well, I don't have it. So you want to resend it to me? Because what?
I can. Do you want that done now, or do you want me to?
Go ahead with the presentation. Okay. Let me see if I can get it.
Yeah, so and we are planning on issuing an unmodified or a clean opinion on the financial statements. And then because you're subject to federal single audit and you report as a government, you're also subject to an audit in accordance with government auditing standards. And as part of that, we are also going to be issuing and reporting on the government auditing standards. All records and information requested by BDO was freely available for inspection, and management cooperation was excellent throughout the whole process. So on that note, for tomorrow, the financial statement that are going to get printed is going to be the financial statement and the government auditing standards report. So just to let you know, just right ahead, that we are not, it's a clean opinion, no findings issued on the government auditing standards side or on the financial statement side. Another area I just wanted to touch on, just part of our audit, the significant risk we usually focus on is we always have to look at management override of controls, usually like journal entries made in the system that usually some of those are outside of your regular internal control process. So those are the items we focus on. We focus a lot of our attention on revenue recognition. Mostly in your case, it's your grant revenue recognition and any state appropriation recognition during the year. Another item to note as far as corrected or uncorrected misstatements, if we had corrected misstatements that we suggested that management made, or if there are items in the financial statement that the management chose not to make any adjustment for, those I would report to you, and we have none of those to report. Internal control over financial reporting. So if we, as part of our audit, we just don't dive into the numbers. We start by getting an understanding of your internal controls over your financial reporting process. And as part of that process, if we find any issues, we would put it into one of the three buckets, either a control deficiency, a significant deficiency, or a material weakness. Any items that we deem to be significant deficiencies or material weakness would be reported to you as part of this communication, and we are not reporting any of that this year. Other than that, one major change in the financial statements this year is you did bring in, since AEA separated from the ADA board for last year, the one big change that happened is the employees move from ADA to AEA instead of contracting in ADA. The employees are part of Alaska Energy Authority itself. For 2020, at the beginning of 2024, the pension liability and the related pension assets and deferred inflows and outflows of resources had to be brought into the financial statements. So that is new this year and is presented as an extraordinary item because that's not something that you expect to happen ever, basically. So the way the allocation is done is the state of Alaska gives you the allocation of the pension liability, the net OPEB assets, and all of that information as part for just for ADA, which includes both the group right now. And then based on the number of employees that are in the defined benefit plan that allocation was done, and about 52% of that liability and asset is booked on AEA's books this year. So that's one change in the current year. Other than that, if there was any alternative treatment that management was doing that they were discussing with other accountants, or any significant unusual transactions or disagreements with management, I would report that to you, but I don't have any of that to report. So that's a brief overview of the audit itself. So now we'll just go through a brief overview of the financial statements itself. And in the draft provided, we will go to page 22. Yeah, the second one.
Apparently, there's something wrong with the PDF. I can't see anything on the PDF.
Do I have someone that I can get the report from? Because I can try to bring it back.
Oh.
Someone has a copy of it?
No, let's see. You know what? I think I can share it from my screen.
I can
share it from my screen.
Can you just go to the internet? Because I haven't seen it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on the internet.
It's on the internet?
Yes,
it is. Okay, someone will have to tell me when to admit what page to put it on, because
it's right in the beginning.
Page 48 of the
PDF.
Must be that Microsoft issue.
Yeah. All kinds of issues.
So what page do I need to be on, somebody? We're on. I'm on 22 of the board packet.
48.
Okay.
Not coming up, is it?
Apparently you can see it on the...
I can see it online.
Online. Yeah. You can't see it. We just can't see it here.
Can we get online?
Let me see if I can share it. Hang on.
Do you want to get my laptop? I have it up on my laptop.
I think it's an issue with this. I'm gonna get to it.
Oh, I have it right here.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Some of the other stuff we're sharing.
I know. We do the equipment.
We just tried to.
Okay, now I need to join. I need to stop sharing up here.
Yeah,
she's joining the team session with this laptop so she can share the screen.
I was just going to say, you could probably open it up on the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Not just us.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. 22 on.
Might be 22 there, yeah.
Okay, let me. I don't know how you can see this.
I'll just make it bigger, maybe that. Just that.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I can't make it any bigger.
Can we make copies of what Vicki has real quick for the board of the chair?
The one of the presentation?
No, we've done that, but the actual numbers.
Yeah, we have them in this, his presentation.
I know.
Yeah, can we share it with the board?
I tried it here.
Right there on the left. So on numbers 9 go over, we don't have in the presentation.
He's reading some something.
Oh, this is off of our...
Okay, I got it.
Which are in there. Yeah.
They're not coming up.
Okay.
How do I drag it over?
Other than that, I can have copies made.
Okay, let's see if we can make it bigger. Yeah, okay, full screen? Nope. That's as good as we're going to get.
You can also make it bigger on the screen.
Or maybe...
Could make the source bigger.
Well,
correct. Yeah. The next segment of next session.
There we go.
Okay. Is that any better?
That's good.
Okay. Do you want me to try to get the whole page on there? Or?
It's fine. I think maybe as we navigate.
Okay.
Right now you can see it. So the first statement here is your statement of net position. So this statement has all of your assets, your deferred outflow of resources, all of your liabilities and deferred inflows of resources, and difference between both of those is your net position. Your statements over here, you do have your governmental activities and your business type activities all combined. One thing to note this year is prior to this year, your governmental activities and your fund financial statements, which appeared to be the same. There was no long-term assets or liabilities recorded in your governmental activities. Basically, the way the GASB prescribes its statements, your governmental activities, your governmental fund financial statements do not have long-term assets and liabilities. So this year, for the first time, you do have long-term liabilities and assets in here. So that's all related to your pension-related activities. So this year, if you were to compare to prior year, the one difference you'll see is you're going to see the net OPEB assets, the deferred inflow and outflow of resources related to your both your pension and OPEB assets and liabilities, and then your net pension liability. So for your total assets at the end of the year was $1.7 billion. $1.1 billion is in your governmental activities, and your business type activities have $614 million. Please note that everything over here is presented in thousands. Out of your total assets, $325 million was cash and cash equivalent. Almost 116 in your governmental activities and 209 million in your business type activities. The other big chunk in your governmental activities is your restricted investments of $960 million. And in your business type activities, you have the capital assets of $375 million. We go to the next page. Next page shows your liabilities. So compared to your assets, your liabilities are only $116 million for your governmental activities and $212 million for your business type activities. This leaves you with your net position at the end of the year of over $1,023 million for your governmental activities and $402 million for your business type activities. Please note that pretty much all of your net position is either invested in your capital assets or restricted for operations of as guided by the legislation or by grant agreements.
Or third-party agreements.
Or third-party agreements. If you go to the next page. The next page, the page before, please. Thank you. In this, can you go down a little bit? Oh, sorry. Right there, that's good. So the only item I wanted to point out over here is that $2.4 million, the extraordinary item. So that was the net effect of all the pension assets, liabilities, deferred inflows and outflows basically brought in at the beginning of the year. So any changes that happen during the year to that liability is our liabilities and assets are running through your expenses in the current year. Next page. Not a lot to talk about in the next few pages because the balance sheet and the income statement, the only difference really between here and the governmental funds is this does not have those pension assets and liabilities. And then I'd go to page 27, one more page after this, yeah. So this statement shows your revenue expenditures and change in fund balance for your governmental funds. This one shows all of your revenue, your expenditures, and then any transfers or other financing sources, leaving you with your change in fund balance. Your total revenue for the year was 137 million, or 130, pretty much 138 million. 12.8 of that came from federal grants, 24.4 was state appropriation, and then 98 million was your investment income for the year. Your expenditures mostly follow your revenue other than your investment income. Your grants and projects were 38.9 million. Power cost equalization grants were 46.8 million. And you also had a $30 million contribution to the state this year. This left you basically with your change in fund balance of 12.6 million this year. Just main item to note over here, your change in fund balance is really dependent on that investment income during the year. Following that, I'm going to go a couple more pages to the statement of revenue and expenses for the enterprise funds. Yeah, right there. So similar to governmental funds, this one has your revenues, your expenditures, your non-operating revenue, and leaving you with your change in net position for the year. Total revenue for your enterprise funds was $32 million. Most of that was your revenue from your operating plants, and then expenditures basically follow your revenue there to $25.8 million for the year, investment income of $8.6 million, leaving you with almost $3 million in change in net position for the year. So that's a brief overview of the statements. I do want to let you know that behind the notes to the financials, there are combining schedules that show the activity by the different funds that you have that combined together in the front over here. Your notes to the financials this year is different from prior years. It's gone up by about 10 pages because of all the pension-related disclosures. And then the other item I do also want to highlight is starting last year, your investments are invested through the Alaska Permanent Fund. So there is a lot of different portfolios that they are invested in, and all that information detail is in the financial statements. One thing to also note that we don't audit that statement at the Permanent Fund, and those are included here based on audited reports that we got for those that portfolio. So that's a brief overview of the financial statement on my end. Is there any areas in here that you'd like me to cover?
Any questions from the board? Any questions online?
I got a question.
Mr. Mitchell.
That's it from me. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question on timing in your initial presentation. You talked about you weren't sure when certain things were going to get done. And I know that, you know, AEA has loan programs and other things, and they typically require a condition precedent, you know, to have your audited financial statements complete. Maybe this is more of a question to include the executive director, but I want to make sure your timing isn't going to impair anything that management's trying to do and timely have certain things done. So are these, is everything, you left very loose ends, like, me, you know, we're working on this, we're going to get this, rather than a hard date. So I just want to make sure that we're in synchronization with what management needs.
Yeah. No, we are releasing the financial statements, which is other than the federal single audit, tomorrow. So that is within the timeline. And then everything that you need for all of the activities you just talked about is really that financial statement tomorrow. So the federal single audit is a separate report. That's basically just make sure that you're compliant with the federal single audit requirements, but those are not what's required for all of your other
bond
covenants. So.
Which is tomorrow.
Thank you for that answer. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Any other board questions? Okay, doesn't look like it.
Thank you very much.
I would just like to make one final comment.
Sure, Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, this isn't so much as a question, it's just a comment. Thank you very much for the report, as well as the good, clean bill of health that it appears that you have drafted for how AEA is running things. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. On item 7 of your agenda is a committee report. We had asked, there was a special committee on project financing, primarily looking at the Bradley expansion, Dixon diversion, and also looking at the Cook Inlet Power Link, also known as SIP Link, or the GRIP project. And we've done a lot of internal meetings as well as meeting with the special committee. And one of the things that have come out of it that we wanted to share was the ORIC summary on AEA financing options of what tools do we have available to us by our statutes. And so we have asked ORIC to provide that, and they provided a two-page memo listing our bonding authority as well as whether we can enter into public-private partnerships, issuing loans, developing loans as far as gifts, and ownership operations, and also what legislative approval that we need. Basically, I think to summarize here, is AEA has very broad authority to take loans out. We have very broad authority with bonding. I think the two biggest parts of the bonding and the loan is we do not need legislative approval, and there is no cap. Now, obviously, there's a cap of what the market is willing to lend us based on our projects. There is that, which is the market dynamics. But as far as a cap for us, there is not. And that's important when we look at the next item. There's a resolution, and Mark can come and walk you through it. But we have an opportunity through the Loan Participation Office, or Loan Program Office, to borrow or make an application to borrow a lot of the money that we need for the Bradley expansion and the SIP link, depending on some definitions that we get from the Department of Energy, whether it qualifies. But I think more importantly than anything, it's just a two-page snapshot of what we have the ability to do. It's interesting that the railroad has to get permission to build a dock, but we can bond $350 million, and we need to notify the legislature, and there's a process of doing that, but we don't need to go through the legislative process for it. So it's just kind of unique in that, but it was just easier to have a summarized document of what we can and can't do. And with that, I'll invite Mark up to discuss the LPO application. One thing I will say that was one of the good, when you walk in on a Thursday morning of a board meeting, sometimes I'm afraid to open up my emails. But one of the good news is that you have to be invited to apply. And we have been working through that process to be invited to apply. And normally the threshold is $1 billion. And they've actually invited us to apply with the information that's been provided to apply for a loan, which is a great, great step forward for us, but it also depends on what you guys want us to do. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Director Thayer. This is Mark Billingsley. I'm General Counsel for the Alaska Energy Authority. That's right. There was a meeting of the Finance Subcommittee of the AEA Board about 2 or so months ago. That was a public meeting. There was a whole lot discussed at that meeting, and we're continuing to progress through this process of figuring out financing for these two large projects, Dixon and the SIP Link project. One of the preferred options is, or one of the options that the board is going to be considering is a loan through the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office, and it's because it has a much lower interest rate than you can get just about anywhere else. As Director Thayer said, usually the cap is, or the minimum is $1 billion, but we're working with them to, a $1 billion loan, working with them to access loaned monies at under $1 billion total. But this resolution is pretty simply that you can't submit an application without written authorization for, or the executive director needs written authorization from the board. So this is just that the board needs to give written authorization for the executive director to submit the application. That's really, this is pretty simple, but the discussion about financing these projects is much bigger, and the finance subcommittee is really working through that. Happy to answer any questions in that regard, but this resolution is really pretty straightforward. So it's a Title 17, the Loan Program Office, and it, you can read in there, the board authorizes the executive director to make such attestations, representations, and commitments as may be required by the LPO and to take all actions necessary or appropriate to effectuate the submission and processing of the application. Happy to answer any questions on that.
Any questions, board?
I have a question. Since we're applying to the LPO office and they're requiring resolution, this resolution meets those gates?
It does, yes.
Thank you.
It says it can be in the bylaws, but it's not specifically written out there. We talked about whether we could try to rely on the bylaws, but it's cleaner just to have a resolution to make sure we have no hang-ups as we go through this very long process with the DOE. Or it can be in a resolution or some other written form, but this is the cleanest, most certain way of making sure that our application, this component of our application, is acceptable.
I'm ready to make a motion if there's any other.
Any other board questions? Okay, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the resolution. Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that the board approve resolution 2205 authorizing executive director to submit applications and addenda to the U.S. Department of Energy Loan Programs Office as presented and included in the board packet.
Tony Izzo, I'll second the motion.
Okay, you have a motion and a second. Is there any board discussion? Okay, hearing none, a roll call vote, please.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman? Absent. Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Chair Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, I'm going to revert to item 6 on the agenda, the presentation of the audit. I kind of skipped over an action item there. So, board, you have a copy of the audit, and we have the presentation of the audit. So I'd entertain a motion for the Alaska Energy Authority Board to accept those fiscal year 2025 draft financial statements as presented. Mr. Izzo.
Mr. Chair, I move that the board accept the Alaska Energy Authority fiscal year 2025 draft financial statements as presented.
And I can make that second.
I have a motion and a second. Any discussion of the board? Okay, hearing none, roll call vote, please.
Yes. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiasen?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman is absent. Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Chair Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay. Thank you for keeping me on agenda, Mr. Izzo. So we don't have any old business this meeting, I believe. So new business is board meeting schedule. And those dates are outlined. Director Thayer?
Yes. Just because pre-planning for 2026, we had offered up four different dates for the next for 2026. What I would like to note is on January 26th, we would like to include a strategic planning. We'll talk a little bit more in executive session, but we were looking to maybe do an all-day session where we'd have a board meeting and then do the strategic review or something along those lines here in Anchorage and try to get as many board members present as possible. And then our April 16th meeting, our June 30th, our July 30th, which should be our annual meeting. And then we also have October 29th, but it also dawned on me that we have an election the following Tuesday. and that we might want to delay the meeting until November 3rd, which is the following Thursday. Not saying that we're going to have an outcome, but it would at least give us some guidance, I think, forward, because our next meeting after that would be in January. So it might be prudent for us just to have our next meeting or our last meeting in November 3rd. Not saying we can't have a special meeting, but I think that would give us a little bit of clarity on direction forward.
Okay. And then would you like to see from the board if we have known conflicts or something, just get those to Jennifer?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. It's just if you could let us know what dates might be in conflict or that, so we can at least get them on the calendar, reserve the room. And at least I would like to be at least two meetings ahead, if possible.
Okay.
But the November 3rd just was an obvious one.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any board comments or discussion on the proposed meeting schedule for next year? Okay, hearing none. Director comments.
All right. A lot of information, so I will go through it because I know we have an executive session. But one of the commitments that we've made, or I've made, and that is we're going to keep the board regularly updated on our budget. Granted, our budget and our budget documents look like nothing like the private sector, but it would give you an idea of where we're at. And so we'll have the next ones in January, which will look back on the last 6 months. But what this is how we ended fiscal year 25. And I think it's important to note with this is we have basically four buckets of money. We call them components that our budget sets in. Our employees don't always set in, they might set in one bucket or two, not all four. Depends on the size of the program. But through the overall component size, we had a final budget of $65,285,000, of which we, our actuals for FY25 was $56 million, excuse me. So we were under budget. Primarily, that was as we did not do as much work on the SimpLink as we had expected to do. And the reason for that is we had a go, a pause, a go, a pause, and now we're back to go. So that one went in and out a little bit, so we didn't spend as much money as we anticipated. So overall, we did very well as far as staying within our budget. And with that, there was also some personnel costs that we are right now running a 34% vacancy factor, which is extremely high. Part of that has to do with our SimpLink and the fact that until we start doing into more in construction, we have positions, but we're not hiring for them at that time. But again, we are still struggling. We had, just an example, we have our procurement. We had one procurement person. We're supposed to have four. So we now have two. So now we're going to try for three. But with the different components, our owned assets, that particular component, we were short. Our budget was $1.2 million, of which we did just a little over $1 million with that one. When we look at our AEA power cost equalization program, we had authorized $48.2 million, and our actuals were $47.2 million, so we're under $1 million. That one's a little harder to track because you're trying to track the cost of what the fuel is going to be, and that does fluctuate. And then we have alternative energy and energy efficiency. This one in particular is where we had final authorization of 6.3. We spent just a little under $1 million. And again, that was some of our IIJ dollars as far as the timing of those projects. So I just want to make sure you have that budget. And then I'm going to ask Mark Billingsley to come back up. The governor has issued AO360, which is a regulatory requirement reduction project, and just wanted to give you guys a status update and next steps to meet the governor's goal of reducing regulations by the end of this year by 15% and 25% by December 31st, 2027.
That's right. This is Mark Billingsley of the Alaska Energy Authority. I don't know if we've talked about this at a board meeting. I don't think we have these. I think this might have come out since the previous board meeting. So the governor issued Administrative Order 360, and it requires all agencies to look at their regulations and cut them by 15% by the end of next year and 25% by the end of the following year. and that includes review of their guidance documents. So we're definitely not alone in this. It's a really big undertaking for everybody, AEA included, but some agencies are just really overwhelmed with this. So we've had to go through all of our regulations and first identify all of our guidance documents. They're requiring a reduction based on page number or word count. And for the regulations, so they're not requiring a reduction in the number of regulations. They're requiring a reduction in the number of regulatory requirements that are discretionary. If it's a mandatory regulatory requirement, they're not requiring a reduction of that, but a reduction in the number of regulatory requirements that are discretionary. So we actually had to go through and count up all of the regulatory requirements, figure out how many of those were discretionary versus statutorily required. And now we need to come up with a plan for reducing that number by 15% or by 25% by the year after that. We also had to go through a process of getting stakeholder input on this. So we held two public meetings this month at the beginning, first 2 weeks of this month. We didn't have anybody call into either one of them. They're each an hour long. We received two public comments, one from the Alaska Municipal League and one from a firm in Washington, D.C. They're not highly specific, but they're more general overall. We encourage you to reduce the number of regulatory requirements. So we're taking those into account, reviewing them in detail, and we'll figure out how we can incorporate their recommendations into our plan for reducing the number of regulatory requirements. Our plan is due to DCCED, who rolls it up into the statewide plan at the end of December, and it goes up to the governor's office, I believe, on January 5th. And then we got to proceed with reducing the number of regulatory requirements, and Department of Law has to process all this, and they've got their hands full because they have to review all the regulatory modifications. Happy to answer any questions.
Keyboard, any questions on the budget or the reductions?
Sure.
Mr. Izzo.
Is there coordination between other entities, other agencies? Thinking about a current issue where DOT is not issuing permits. In fact, there's even a question about whether it's what they've done is under statute, but it affects the ability for utilities to recover costs of relocations in the future. That directly affects the cost of energy to consumers, so it touches on our mission here, and I'm just that issue being current and being addressed with that agency and the commissioner is underway. And I just wonder if there's any crossover between various agencies or corporations within the state.
So we are meeting jointly with the other Department of DCCED subunits. And we're talking about how we're doing this, and then DCCED level, they're meeting with the other agencies within the state of Alaska, so they're coordinating, and then it all rolls up to the governor. So in that way, we're coordinating. We're really, though, just sharing our experience and going through the process, like I'm running into this problem, they're running into this other problem, maybe we can learn from each other. We're not coordinating like that's about as far as the coordination goes. And then as far as any issues that anybody has, you still have the opportunity to provide input to that agency and suggest how you think that their regulations could be streamlined. And the governor and the people who are running this program are very encouraging of the public to provide input. So you have that opportunity.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. I just had a structural question. So the EEA's financials, do those flow up to DCCED or kind of OMB or something?
Thank you for the question. They flow up to the state, state financials, because we are an independent corporation, as is others, and then it does roll up as a component of the states. It used to be called the CAFR. They changed the name of it recently, which is a consolidated accounting of the state.
Okay.
But it rolls up to the state.
Great. I just saw the budget summaries on DCCED, and I figured that was probably the process. So, all right, thank you. Any other questions, board, on the regulatory relief or the budget? Okay, Director Thayer.
All right. Next item on the agenda is what we have as a Senesham AEA ADA MOU. AEA, back in 1991, there was an agreement with multiple parties, including the state of Alaska, and if you want, you can actually see Governor Wally Hickel's signature on the document. But in the document, there was an agreement among the municipality, Chugach, MEA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries, and the Alaska Energy Authority, and the state of Alaska, relative to Clutin and Senesham. The Clutin issue has been pretty much resolved. It's still ongoing with a couple of outstanding issues with the governor asking for a couple of studies done. But in this document, it also says AEA shall be responsible for the consultation, study, and implementation provisions applicable to the Senesham project. We don't own the Senesham project. We have no relationship to the Senesham project. It's actually an owned asset of our sister agency, ADA. And this was actually, this document predated probably ADA's ownership of Senesham. But what we did is we worked with an MOU with the with ADA. And basically what that this does is that all of our responsibilities for this 1991 agreement transfers to ADA, and they're responsible for the study, the implementation, and everything of their asset. Because the one thing the document in 1991 did not do is establish who would pay for all the work that needed to be done by AEA. But clearly it's an ADA asset. And so we just did a very simple MOU and transferred those duties and responsibilities to ADA. And so what you have is that MOU as well as the backup document for that.
Questions or comments, Board? Mr. Rizzo.
Thank you, Chair. Curtis, this is more for my information. Historically, so ADA owns Senesham. The agreement talks about Alaska Energy Authority. Was there some transfer of ownership? And apologies for being naive. I'll assume ADA was in existence in 91?
Right. ADA was in existence, but their ownership of Senesham had not occurred yet. And in 1991, again, how we got into the mix with the Juneau project, I think, is because we were the Alaska Energy Authority, and that's how that was selected. We can't find any really historical documents or anything that can identify why we got invited into that project 34 years ago. But due to the fact that ADA now owns the project and has legal rights to it, then they need to be responsible for those activities to do with this agreement. So
just follow up. So there is some document transfer of ownership of Senesham by ADA.
Yes.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Other questions, Board?
Just a point. Senesham was originally federally owned, and then that's how ADA received it when they were divesting of it. And then AOMP has they operate it, and they receive the power from it. So it's all an arrangement they have. But we were never part of that. We did some work to it as far as if there's any questions about the dam operation or something like that. Brian Carey was involved in that, but that might have been an hour or two a month, and that was our total involvement in it. It's just trying to clean something off the books. Next item is what we have is federal tracker, and this we have done, we did in the previous 2 years, but had not, and then with the change of administration, we've restarted it. And what this is looking at all of our federal projects that we receive funding to know what's awarded, what the source of the money, the program, the award amount, whether it's a match, required match, how much is outstanding, and then comments on it. And so really this document, we hope not to change that much as it did with the right after the new administration. But what's more important is to kind of look what we have in blue, which is there's still opportunities for us for federal funding. And so as we find those opportunities and we apply for it, we keep a track on this as pending. Whether we get it or not, again, then it comes off if we don't get it. If something's been terminated or canceled, we keep track of that. But it's just to kind of give you an idea. Then our conditional awards, which we have $74 million in conditional. We got it in the previous administration, and we've been told that it's still going to stay forward, but we are still waiting to reach out to our project officer 7 months into it, other than they say it hasn't been canceled. So this is just our internal tracker, but I think it's important that we keep that we provide this as a board in the board packet so you understand where we are with our federal dollars and our opportunities that we're looking at. The next item up on the agenda is the Bradley Lake Expansion Project, and I'd like to invite Ryan McLaughlin, the Senior Infrastructure Engineer, to discuss the project and the status. He's had a very busy summer.
Yeah. Good morning, Board. Just going to give a try to be brief on this update on the Bradley Lake Expansion Project. So we're working hard towards our next major milestone, which is the middle of the draft license amendment application. We're targeting late January of 2026, and right now we're on schedule for that. As we've been putting together, advancing the design and putting together the application, we've realized that there's a need to kind of standardize the nomenclature of everything. So we've rebranded a little bit. The overall project is now called the Bradley Lake Expansion Project with subcomponents, the Dixon Diversion, which is the diversion dam, the tunnel, the inlet and outlet portal. And then we've got the Bradley Pool Raise, which is the spillway crest modifications and the raise of the Bradley Dam itself. So we had a pretty busy last couple of months and a half. We had a drill crew out at Bradley Dam. They mobilized September 15th, I believe, and they just wrapped up about a week ago. They demobbed. They drilled 9 boreholes. Or the plan was to drill 9 boreholes in and around the dam. We drilled some boreholes through the spillway gallery, through the dam crest, on the left embankment and at the toe of the dam. They had a variety of issues, but we were able to get at least one hole drilled in each of the critical areas. The plan was for 10 holes, and we were able to complete 8 of them. And right now we're just downloading and analyzing all the data. But all in all, it was pretty successful, pretty challenging. We got some pictures on the next page. I will say it didn't look like that most of the time. They dealt with a lot of snow in the last couple of weeks. But that first picture, I think, is kind of neat. It's the drill crew, the drill rig, and the trucks on the dam. It gives a little bit of scale of how big the Bradley Dam is. And then that next picture down there is the drill crews working on the dam. They're pretty constrained in the area that they could work in, especially when they were working in the spillway gallery. They had to get some specialized equipment to get that done. But yeah, as I said, they wrapped that up last week, and it was highly successful. On September 17th, I went out with Dal to complete the annual operator training and annual safety inspection of Bradley Dam. This trip also included a site visit to the Dixon Diversion Dam site for the project engineers to evaluate the current design against the site conditions. Yesterday, we had a board of consultants meeting with the BOC and FERC. This was a 8-hour meeting where we talked about the design documents up to this point, discussed that, but the main topic was the PMP and PMF, so discussing what's the maximum flood that we could expect to occur on the Bradley Dam. this study was originally done in the 1980s, so we're redoing it now with all the 40 years of weather data that we've had since that original study was done. We also submitted an inflow design flood recommendation and hazard classification recommendation for the future Dixon Diversion Dam. We requested that the Dixon Diversion Dam be a low hazard dam and that the inflow design flood be the 100-year flood, which correlates to about 7,900 CFS. Last week, we received a letter from FERC that said that they agree with that recommendation, so that was a big win for the project. One of the first items that we have to take care of is the upgrade of the power that goes from the powerhouse up to the dam. Right now, it's single phase, and we're going to be upgrading that to three phase because we want three phase power to power the TDM. So we have EPS designing that, and they'll be producing a design package that we can go out to bid to order the transformers pretty soon because that's a very long lead item. And then next spring or summer, we'll probably try to purchase the rest of the equipment, the cable and the poles, so that we can install that all in the summer of 2027. We also made a couple of other big design decisions. One of the main ones was the decision to fully line the Dixon Tunnel. This should have pretty minimal cost impacts to the project compared to previous cost estimates. It'll improve worker safety inside the tunnel since they'll be in there 24/7 for over a year. It'll improve the hydraulics since it'll be smoother and there won't be any choke points. And it'll reduce the construction risk for the contractor, as we expect that there will be sections that would need to be lined anyway as we cross faults and things like that. So the design criteria has been established for a 14-foot minimum finished ID. So we'll drill a 16-foot diameter tunnel and then a 1-foot concrete liner. And this will provide a maximum flow of 1650 CFS. On the environmental side of things, we wrapped up our final year of environmental studies this summer. So we are complete with the study plan and are just producing the final study reports that we'll review with the agencies this winter. I think we have one more stream gauging trip, and the Department of Fish and Game has to go out there and take some equipment down, but other than that, we're finished with the environmental studies this year. Some highlights from the last month, on August 29th, we did a stream gauging trip and measured the Martin River at 2490 CFS, which was the highest spot measurement that we've taken, which will be really good for building out the stage discharge curve. We've gotten a lot of low to medium flow measurements, but we haven't actually been on the ground when we've had that high of flow. The picture that you can see there was when we went out with Department of Fish and Game. That day, the flow was 220. So when they were out there measuring the flow, it was 10 times the amount of water in that river, which is not uncommon in this system. We counted about 1,500 sockeye through Red Lake, which was also the highest count in the 3 years of monitoring that we've done. And I think this is a picture of the Martin River in a high flow. That about wraps it up. I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Any questions from the board? Yes.
Just as a, this is Cole on Smythe. Just as a point of information for me, you mentioned the transformers, that there's going to be a long lead time. Are you comfortable speaking to maybe how long that lead time is?
We're expecting 18 to 24 months.
Thank you.
We're closer to 18, but yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Mitchell.
in the RFPs and the questions that putting forward, are you looking at the BABA Act, or are you looking at foreign equipment? Or has that decision been made yet? BABA being Buy America, Build America.
There's no federal dollars in this project.
Yeah, correct. So we're not subject to those restrictions for the funding that we have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, Ryan, this isn't critical. Don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have a, is it a transmission transformer that we're looking at? Do you have a, I'm trying to determine what the size is as a follow-up question.
I would have to check with EPS and get back to you. I think it's distribution, but.
Okay. Yeah, on transmission transformers, we're seeing 3 to 4 years. Price increases have been from 36% to 272% at that level. But distribution transformers is a different story.
I believe it's distribution, but I'll double check that.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
Mm-hmm.
This is Commissioner Sandy. If I could just really briefly, and this might be more for Curtis, but for the public record, I think it's important to talk about the value of the project and why AEA is pursuing this project. I always love the statistics, but can you just briefly address why this project is important in terms of the expected increase in output? And then also, can you just report really briefly on if there was any outreach done? I know, you know, Curtis and the team, you guys do a great job of trying to get folks from the legislature, other officials out to the site so that they can see the project and be aware of why it's important. So I just wanted to know if there was any summer outreach that was done to the project.
Thank you, Commissioner, on that. Just on the statistics side of it, this will increase the potentially the output of Bradley by 50%, which currently Bradley is 10% of the row belt, and this would increase it to 15%. Also, with the time schedule that we have, it's to have water flowing at the end of 2030. That also is pertinent with the natural gas situation here in Cook Inlet, because that would supply 7.5% of the unmet requirements that we currently have, or displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas once this is flowing. So it's very important to put that in context. As far as outreach, we did do 2 trips, but we had to cancel some trips due to the travel freeze. But we did have members of the Chugach board and legislators out there. In addition, we hosted a FERC commissioner out there, who Commissioner Chang, who I would say is kind of taken this project under her wing and wants to help shepherd it through the process, which I think is extremely helpful. But does that answer your question, Commissioner, or did I miss anything?
No, it does. Thank you. That's really just important. And I think, you know, when we do the report out, if possible, just to have a couple of sentences for the general public or folks who may not be familiar with the project, just have a sense of why it's so valuable, because I love this project and it helped me a lot to do, to fly over it and see it and spend that time. And Curtis, you were really great. I think I was brand new on the board or pretty new then, and I was just trying to sponge in all of the information. But it reminded me when Ryan was just reporting out on the salmon about the habitat and the value to the habitat. And I think, you know, if at some point you guys can just provide little blurbs of information like that. It was news to me that, you know, there was so much study in advance of the project and opposition to the project and worry that, you know, that the project could harm the salmon. And in fact, you know, you guys could indicate after the fact ways in which it actually helped the habitat. And so I just think information like that, I keep trying to figure out how to get more information out to the general public about the positive nature of so many of our projects. So it's just a suggestion. Thank you.
No, thank you. And normally we do trips in June and July and into August. And so we do have that budgeted and approved to do those trips. And so I know some of the board members have been to Bradley. I know obviously Tony has. Clay has. And so we will want to do that where we can get board members there. Again, we've hosted Senator Murkowski out there. We've hosted FERC commissioners out there, other board member, other boards of other organizations on the robot. So we want to do that again pretty aggressively. So look for some dates, because in June and July, that's what we'll be doing again and starting that up.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Sandy. And I think there's the videos on the EA website as well that helps explain some of the value and some good visuals of the project. So, right. Other questions, comments on the Bradley expansion? All right, thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
All right, next up is Jim Mendenhall, and he's going to discuss owned assets outside of the Bradley expansion, Cook Inlet Power Link, and then also our transmission upgrades.
Bill's also here in the room.
Good morning, Jim Mendenhall with AEA. Happy to give you an update on the some of the owned assets, starting with Cook Inlet Power Link. We're still, of course, the DOE is, they've got a skeleton crew there that is doing some work. They have not made any public announcements about which projects have been approved. They did on October 9th issue a letter that said there was termination of 223 projects rescinding about $7.5 billion. SIPLINK was not on that list. We are continuing our discussions with DOE. We are putting our paper, since there was a pause, we had originally put a recommendation to move to the next phase of the project. Our first phase ended on June 30th. And they have authorized us to go ahead and start those renegotiations. And we expect to probably have an answer around Thanksgiving, complete that next period. So we're doing that. The environmental review, prior to the shutdown or prior to their process review, we had talked to them about issuing a NEPA permit for our work out in the inlet that we have to do for environmental studies. They issued that within about 10 days. We have issued a contract with HDR for some environmental services for out in the inlet, and that we expect that field work to happen in 2026. We realized that in order to stay on schedule, even though we were shut down, AEA made the decision that we would go ahead and authorize one of the tasks we had Stantec had proposed on, which was helping us prepare all the documents for procurement of the long lead items, specifically the cable and the converter stations. That is notice to proceed has been issued and given to Stantec, and they are starting to work with suppliers and prepare specifications. And then we will, they will come back and we will work with them on some recommendations. One of the other things we've done is, besides reviewing our pricing and working on the solicitations, is I think you're aware that AEA, through on a separate effort, has been working on a Rail Belt strategic transmission plan. So we've spent some time looking at the transmission plan and verifying how that fits with our SIPLINK projects, the interfaces, terminus, and those things. So we are nearing completing that. Our funding has not changed. We still have $64.2 million in combined state appropriation Bradley bonds, and we have the $142 million left to raise. To date, we've spent about a little less than $1.5 million on the project. And that's kind of the quick update. Are there any questions on SIPLINK?
Yeah, following up on Commissioner Sandy's comments, I think it's important to note that how this project is linked to the Bradley expansion. Bradley is larger today than the transmission line capacity at 75 megawatts is, you know, safe operation level. Bradley is larger than 75 megawatts. Thankfully, hydro is nature's best energy storage that provides firm power. So SIPLINK provides that second transmission line that allows us to take advantage of not only some of the Bradley. We don't lose any of the Bradley. I mean, for the public record, we use all that energy. We just currently don't use it when it would be the most efficient because of the capacity constraint. This second line will not only allow us to do that, but it facilitates being able to take that 50% or so increase provided by the Dixon diversion, which again offsets 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas. So I just think it's important to put them together just for the public record.
Mr. Izzo, I would agree completely. Bradley has a nameplate capacity of about 120 megawatts. As you pointed out, the current transmission coming up the Sterling and the Seward Highway has the capacity of about 75 megawatts. At that transmission level, we're losing about 10% in losses. You know, if you figure that the Kenai uses less than 20 megawatts, there's still 100 megawatts that have to come off of Bradley when it's at full power. So, there's an issue there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Completely agree, Jim. It's just part of the fragile, we call it a grid. Within the rail belt electrics, we often refer to it as an extension cord. I recall the single line that exists today is capacity constrained during the Swan Lake fire. That line was out, and power consumers north of the peninsula paid an extra $12 million over that 3 months for their energy because we had to burn more natural gas to get it, to displace it. So both of these projects are critically linked and critically important. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And that loss component's huge. I mean, when you have those both lines and can split that and get your losses down, more of that power ends up to the customers. So, all right. Any other questions, Board?
Bill, do you want to give an update on the SSFT?
Bill Price, Senior Infrastructure Engineer with AEA. Just a quick update on the SS and SQ upgrades. The SS, as you guys may recall, went over budget and was tabled. Project is still loosely planned, but not budgeted and not scheduled. The SQ received its in August, October. We got steel bids back. The steel bids were roughly close enough. They were a little bit over, but they were close enough that we're moving ahead. The project is on schedule to complete the SQ upgrades. The EAs has been finalized and submitted. They're working through the SHPO issues at the moment, and they're just working through all the little details to move the project forward.
Questions, Board? Okay, thank you.
All right. Next up on the agenda is just an update. As far as the Battle Creek bond subsidies from the IRS, if you recall, I raised the issue at more than one board instance where we were having difficulties receiving two checks from the IRS due to some address issues and direct deposit issues and also some lock boxes with U.S. Bank. Good news is we have all the checks now. Between total checks, it amounts to over $1 million. This last two checks was just under $520,000. And I will have to publicly acknowledge that it was Senator Sullivan's office who got involved in working with the IRS to help resolve this issue and get those checks issued and issued to the right address. But at the same time, we did have some concerns with our bond bank, or not bond bank, excuse me, but U.S. Bank who holds our bonds, as far as maybe how responsive they were. And some of the issues necessarily weren't all to be blamed on the IRS. There was a meeting that we had, Mark and I, you can guess who played the good cop, who played the bad cop. But at the end of the day, we're going to have a new representative for our account, and they're going to cover all the lost interest while the checks were in transit for the last 10 months. In addition to that, they are also now going to check the box of direct deposit, which was an error on their part for not doing that. We had direct deposit, and we had a retirement, and the gentleman we dealt with after 40 years, I guess he wanted to retire. And with that, with the change, we had some people that weren't just quite as attentive as they could be. But we're back on track, and we're going to be made whole for the interest loss. So I just want to give that update. That was a positive. That actually, that was an email from this morning that came in and said, we reviewed your claim, and we're going to pay it. So I do appreciate U.S. Bank for being responsive to that. Next item in your board packet under owned assets is just a letter from Commissioner Chang as she visited the project on June 30th and highly complimentary of AEA and the staff. And again, this is one of those projects where she, I think, wants to kind of take it under her wing to move it forward. And this is the second commissioner that we've had out at the project. As far as rural program updates, we have Denali Commission Awards update. Is Chris going to do it or is Tim going to do it?
Chris
McConnell is going to do it. And then we have a power cost equalization endowment fund update, which is in your packet. And then Chris will also do the Typhoon Hailong update also.
Curtis, could I just interrupt really quick and just ask you to comment on whether or not, I know we talked a little bit about this when representatives from the Department of Energy were approached us at Select USA and were very, very interested in the projects in Alaska and helping to support Alaska. But can you just briefly talk about whether or not that has been an improvement or a change at all, or if there's always been that level of interest from the Department of Energy and working to support AEA, or if we're noticing a difference?
I would, Commissioner, I would say that we're seeing a change, an improvement. You know, the one thing, and I, this is not to be political, but the last administration handed out lots of money. But as far as how to engage and get that money and actual some of the projects, the technical side, I think, was lacking. And this one and this administration is focused on the technical on how can we make something happen. Matter of fact, and this is just an example, it affects us to a certain degree, but Secretary Wright just issued instructions to FERC that NGOs cannot stop a project. They can be considered in the process of a FERC license, but they're not a veto. We don't have any real opposition to Bradley Lake, to the expansion, so that's good. But we're seeing that positive momentum. And just on a side note, a small group of us are going to go to Washington, D.C. next month, and we're going to meet with the Grid Deployment Office. We're going to meet with NEVI. We're going to meet with the Loan Office. We're meeting with FERC. I'm saying these are ones where they want us to come back and talk about our projects and show our projects. There's a couple of opportunities through the Department of Energy for technical assistance that we're applying for, and it's not a little bit, it's $5 or $20 million in technical assistance in some of these topics. And so we are seeing, I think, a little different tone in that, considering they've been there for 7 months. But we are seeing definitely more interest in Alaska. So thank you for the question.
Thanks very much.
Good morning, Chris McConnell, Rural Energy Programs Manager. Our DC awards for bulk fuel, powerhouses, and M&I projects are, as you can see, we have about $20 million left in funding. We just got to substantial completion with a few warranty items in Scammon Bay, so that's our most recent bulk fuel upgrade, quite a good project out there. So that is wrapping up. We also are wrapping up a full powerhouse in Nelson Lagoon. We had a ribbon cutting here, and that's going well as far as in the community. And we have several M&I projects out currently for bulk fuel in Wales and Nelson Lagoon as well, and Diomede and Tununic planned for next spring. We also have a Denali Commission Award that helped kickstart our ANTHC award that for five bulk fuel projects around the state. So we're expecting that award. We just heard yesterday from ANTHC, the first sub-award to get those going in earnest should be coming at the end of this week. I can transition into the
spend. That's a total of $50 million?
It's a total of $50 million over 3 years. This first sub-award is for almost $10 million, which includes, in some cases, construction, other design, and some CDR work as well. And transitioning into the storm update, I believe, is the next item there. And I think that our role, I've been brief giving report out at the daily briefings, the SEOC meetings. I think it's to the credit of our circuit riders and Justin Tuomi, our rural assistance manager, that with all these DC projects we have, I think throughout the state, we have the most comprehensive and deep relationships with those folks on the ground. So that's been quite useful to get minute-by-minute updates. We have been working with the hardest-hit communities, Kipnuk and Quigg, with their utility crew. Their leadership is coming to the office, and so aligning them with the contractors that DOT has brought in to do the work, and most of the damage is distribution. A credit to the engineers and the folks that put the powerhouses together. All of the powerhouses held up pretty well. It's distribution in Quigg and Kip. Kip looks like it's going to be quite an effort to get their distribution up, as they lost most of their houses, whereas Quigg, they lost the south end of town, but the contractors on site working with the utility crew anticipate they're going to get power to the school and then the residences that are out in Kipnuk. It's a loss of residents. We have a distribution project scheduled, another DC award for next year. So we're working with the engineers and the folks on the ground to see how that may be affected. And I think that the SEOC meetings have been quite interesting to watch all of the state agencies come together. It's sort of a microcosm of the rural projects that we have, with the exception that there's enormous resources now. So all the logistics that come into play typically for our projects are happening in a span of a week. And I think, again, the circuit riders have been giving daily and now about every other day updates of the power status through rural Alaska, impacted and marginally impacted. And the last thing I'll say is ACIAC has been in the conversation quite a bit with the outages. That was a non-storm related outage that is still out. They are anticipating getting it back to Saturday. There's been some storm delays as far as getting engines in place, but we've also been working closely with that crew there to get them back up and powered.
Whose engine? Whose generator?
That in ACIAC, we provided freight and circuit rider assistance, but the tribe has paid for that engine. The storm came on the heels of sort of three emergencies where we, emergencies and then critical situations. We barged out an engine to ADAC. We have a standby engine in Tuluksac, and we have, it's slipping my mind right now, but we have got three generators that have been shipped out to help folks get through the winter or get the lights back on in the last month. And then the storm came, and so it's been, like I say, a busy month for our circuit riders and Justin.
And I would just like to make a special note to Cordova Electric, who has a generator we actually, I think, had lent them 20 years ago as a standby, and they're going to be sending that back to us so we can get it refurbished, because we are out of generators for rural Alaska that are operational. We have some where we had some of our neighbors take the wiring harness from and the copper. They were old generators to begin with, given to us by FEMA. But needless to say, we need to get our supply back up and make that available. And in addition, the administration has been very helpful in the sense that we have already expended our allotment for electrical emergencies for the year, and we are only in November. And so they are, the governor's budget is entertaining a supplemental to help cover some of those costs that we had so early in the year.
And Curtis, maybe also worth adding that the transformers that MEA donated in this storm are also, I've talked to the contractor, and they're basically, anytime there's an empty corner of a HERC or any charter going out, they're filtering those into Kipnuk. And I think that they're going to be crucial in the coming months to get Kipnuk back up.
Yeah, very good point. MEA, they had 70 transformers that they've are putting into rural Alaska, and appreciate them as a utility for doing that, because otherwise these communities would not be in any situation to get repair before winter or going into winter.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Board, on the Denali Commission report or the rural assistance? Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, thank you. I want to make a comment, but then also a request and maybe a question. One, you know, when Alaskans, this is an example, when Alaskans pull together when tough times hit, and it's, we've been doing that since time immemorial. When someone's out of food, you help, and even though you got your store. I want to laud you for your AEA's team helping coordinate the cooperation with all the other utilities involved to, you know, provide the basic services and to get the electrical services up. And I think this is a testament to, you know, our Alaska values. So I want to say that. But I would also like to ask that this may not be the last time something like this happens. And our state is endowed with great blessings, but it also has natural disasters of earthquakes, tidal waves, other things. I would ask, as things settle down, that an after-action review be completed. What went well? What could have worked better? As well as lessons learned. And that may prove to be an impetus for additional budgeting so that we're even better prepared for the next round. And I think that that would be a proactive step that we could do as AEA to ensure, and that may be the basis for additional legislative funding or some other funding so that we are, you know, prepared for the next go around. I mean, it's great that MEA is providing things and Cordova is providing things and we're being able to pool, but I don't know if that would even, and I'm stretching this because I would have to see the after action review, whether we have a, you know, SEAL Team 6 package of ready to deploy, you know, to rural Alaska in a future situation. It may not work because each situation is different. You may not be able to prepackage it. I don't know until I would be able to review the after action review, but that would be my suggestion.
Well taken, and I think Curtis has asked us to begin our review of our sort of emergency response at this point, but I'm sure we'll get more detail.
Thank you.
Next item in the package is just for informational purposes, and that was, since the power cost equalization endowment fund is managed by the permanent fund, what we included was the independent auditor's report that was issued to the permanent fund regarding PCE, so it's in your board packet. Again, they manage the fund. We have no control over how it's managed, but obviously important to include the permanent fund audit in there. So we did that. The next item we have is the renewable energy efficiency update regarding electric vehicles. And Nevi, you're pointing over here. Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Audrey Alstrom, Director of the Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Team here. Through the chair, I'll summarize the team's update, which you can find in your meeting packet. First up, NEVI, or the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, which we're partnering with the Alaska Department of Transportation on quite the change from the last meeting in July, where we shared that the program was suspended. Since then, the Federal Highway Administration issued new guidance that basically reduced plan requirements and gave states 30 days to provide an updated NEVI plan. Happy to share the team was able to submit the updated plan in September and received approval earlier in the month, which gives us access to fiscal year 22 through fiscal year 26 NEVI funds for implementation. So we're moving forward with program activities. A copy of the approval letter and the approved plan are in your meeting packet and also can be found on our website. And then let's see, on the Arid side, or the Alaska Rural EVSE deployment project, that is moving along. This is just a reminder that these are DOE grant funds to support EV charging equipment in rural Alaska. And then through the Alaska Electric Vehicle Working Group, we hosted a working group meeting and gave, which we gave an update on the NEVI program, EV, and then kind of upcoming outreach activities. On the solar front, it is also a change from the last meeting. As you might have heard, the Environmental Protection Agency, which was funding that program, terminated the Solar for All program nationwide. So we're working through the closeout process for that federal award. Let's see. The programs on the Energy Efficiency and State Energy Program, or SEP, side, they're moving towards completion. These are the grants we're partnering with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on, or AHFC. Those include SEP, training for residential energy contractors, home efficiency rebates, home electrification and appliance rebates, and then the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant, or EECBG. I will just say that through EECBG and SEP, we are planning to open a request for applications for REV efficiency projects over the coming quarter. More details to come, and we'll give an update on that probably in the next board meeting. And then lastly, on the biomass program side, we supported training for cordwood boiler operators this past summer, and we received two new U.S. Forest Service awards, one award to conduct engineering design for several biomass projects throughout the state that we had supported feasibility studies on prior. And they look to be good projects. And then the other award is to design and construct the biomass project in Tok, which will support the school there. That's my update. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, board?
One thing I just wanted to note is with the NEVI program, and actually spearheaded with Josie, but we did get approval for the plan that was submitted. So that's a big step forward, because under the previous administration, we were 3 years waiting to get it approved. And we got this one approved literally within a couple of months. So,
Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, Audrey, I see Ms. Ahlstrom. I see you getting up. I have some questions for you. The NEVI program, and I have more than one question. The NEVI program, I saw when we got our funding cut that, you know, maybe all of the great planning that went in with all the public meetings for all of the chargers, not only on the Alaska, the main route between Anchorage and Fairbanks, but also Southeast Alaska. Does the 22 and through 2026 planning funds still include the Alaska Marine Highway chargers, or was that outside that range of years?
Correct. The FY22 through 26 funds does include highways outside the alternative fuel corridor, the alternative fuel corridor being the highway between Anchorage and Fairbanks. We still have to get approval that the corridor is built out before we move off corridor, but we should have more than enough funds to do that. And so that's the next phase, yes, correct.
Well, I thank you, because that's been in the public meetings that I've been involved with in Southeast Alaska, that's been very important. It's even more critical now because of the recent private barge companies deciding not to transport electric vehicles. So the only means right now to many of our communities is through the Marine Highway system, which does allow the transport for electric vehicles. Leading into that question, has the Alaska Electric Vehicle Working Group taken any positions or any concerns with the shipment of vehicles to and from Alaska?
Well, at this point, we have just shared information about that and how people can transport EVs. And I understand the ferry system is limiting to two vehicles per sailing. So, you know, that's something we're aware of, and you know, how we get involved is still up for discussion.
Right, and I just put it for situational awareness for AEA, rest of the board members. This issue is already being discussed in letters flying from legislators regarding this, because some communities have really high per capita of electric vehicles, and this would have a chilling effect. I would also point out one other point of reference is that the Subaru dealer in Juneau is either ranked 1, 2, or 3 in the country of electric vehicle sales in the nation, and their sales have completely stopped. So there's a high demand for vehicles that are still out there, and they just cannot be met. A couple of the other smaller dealers have said they will try to route them through Skagway or whatever to try to get on the Alaska Marine Highway voyages, but it's a tough road. So appreciate everything you're doing with the working group and folks, and we'll continue to see how this situation evolves. Thanks.
Thanks. And I'll just point out Josie is here. She usually gives up the NEVI program update, and she's been a big leader in making sure our plan is updated and approved and helping with all the outreach activities. Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And thanks to Josie.
Other questions, comments, board? Yes.
Just one as a point of information. It's mentioned under the independent site deployment. This is page 6, that the Tesla charging stations may or may not count as NEVI creditable. Do we have any ideas as to when we might know if they're creditable or not?
For that question, I'm going to bring up Josie, if you guys don't mind. She is more intimately aware of the Tesla sites.
Thanks for the question. So the Tesla sites were originally selected under our preliminary solicitation for the alternative fuel corridor. There were 9 sites that were selected. 4 of those were awarded to Tesla. Given the uncertainty around the NEVI program, Tesla had elected to move forward with the construction of those sites absent the NEVI funding. So actually a couple of those sites are already commissioned between Anchorage and Fairbanks. So that's been a great benefit for EV drivers. As far as whether or not those sites will be creditable, they were built to more or less the same spec that they had been designed for with the NEVI program. Under the previous administration, there were pretty strict requirements applied to sites that were to be deemed creditable along an alternative fuel corridor. In addition, there were different requirements tied to the spacing between sites, which have more or less been removed under the program guidance for this administration. So we believe that there is a path forward for those sites to be included along the alternative fuel corridor suite of sites that will count as creditable. I think that, like I said before, there's just a lot more flexibility with this administration, and it appears as though they're not so tied to what was the previous program guidance, and they are more focused on getting the money out the door and getting the sites constructed and putting some money out on the street into the economy. So it seems like there's a pretty good path forward for those sites to be considered creditable, but that's just something that we have to address with Federal Highways.
Okay. Open-ended at the moment.
It's open-ended, but we feel pretty confident that we'll be able to use them.
That's great.
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Connor, I'd like to invite Connor Erickson up just to give a report on the planning department. Oh, sorry. You're bending over. I didn't see you.
Oh.
That or hiding. Like at a Coldplay concert.
Connor Erickson, Director of Planning with the Energy Authority. Just want to give kind of an update on the net metering program. So this program has been kind of going through some various iterations, but ultimately was launched back in, I believe it was earlier this summer. The intent of the program was to have those net metering participants that are currently enrolled through their utility programs to be compensated at a rate that's equivalent to that as if they were effectively receiving that energy at their at the prevailing residential rate under the utility tariff. The program is structured the utilities that are eligible under the program are those that are required to have a program under RCA regulation. And as a part of that, the program is also voluntary. It's not, you know, this is not something that utilities are required to participate in. But as the way the program is currently structured, we've seen kind of a general absence of interest in the program. So at present, internally, we're doing some internal review of the program and looking to coordinate with the utilities and are currently undergoing some programmatic review and proposing some structural changes to the program, but still maintaining the ultimate intent, which is to kind of understand how increased participation may ultimately impact utility rate structures going into the future, as well as trying to determine, you know, how that may impact utility operations, as there is some kind of financial impacts to utilities given their structure as generally member-owned cooperatives, and so their limitations on how they're able to recover costs, both variable and fixed, under those under that structure. So kind of the two of the principal means by which we intend to look to do that is to kind of revert it to say, instead of doing kind of a subsidized rate structure, that it would be kind of an initial subsidy in terms of helping to defray the initial high capital cost of installing those net metering installations on consumer property. And so looking to kind of help expedite the rate of return on that. So ultimately the effect is the same. It's just the manner in which the mechanism by which that's achieved, and offering some potential additional preference to those where a battery would be incorporated along with that structure, giving it more value ultimately to both the consumer and the utility in terms of, you know, when that energy may be used and made available for purposes of defraying some of the more expensive natural gas generation.
You got another list?
Our project.
Oh, sorry. Oh, excuse me. Sorry. This is continuing on with the planning update. Excuse me. I was. So the Power Project Fund has seen a pretty significant uptake in interest here just over the past couple months. Just recently, the loan committee approved a loan for the community, or the electric utility, Vernick Power Company, which is the electric utility, certificated electric utility for the community of Kungiganek. It was a fairly small dollar value ultimately, but still serves as kind of a critical means by which the utility is able to pay kind of a large bill for services that were rendered on some of its generating assets within their powerhouse. So both general maintenance as well as installation of a new generator in their powerhouse, and the utility and kind of evidence as to some astute financial and operational management sought to leverage the program to absent the program, they would probably have to raise rates over the short term to recover those costs. And so in order to not have to do that, they called up AEA and said, hey, we'd like to take out a loan, and said that's great. And so in effect, ultimately, they've ultimately reduced the cost of that project and look to amortize that over a 5-year term. So definitely, you know, significantly reduce the cost, and there's deemed to be very, very little risk to the utility ultimately in servicing that debt incurred. The second one would be, well, I should say, I'm going to insert something here, since there has been an occurrence since the drafting of this memo, but that is with the Native Village of Kipnuk have sought to leverage PPF program to act as a bridge loan while they await the arrival of FEMA funds. But some of that is the restoration of electrical service within the community to assist with the recovery efforts going on there, as while the powerhouse is largely survived in good operation, their distribution infrastructure took a pretty significant hit due to the catastrophic damage inflicted by Typhoon Halong. And so we actually have a meeting with the PPF loan committee this afternoon to go over the approval of that request. Going back to the memo, Native Village of Atka has informed AEA that they will be looking to leverage the PPF program for a loan and what we anticipate being about $4.9 million as part of their capital stack to finance the cost of a hydrogen battery, which they'll look to, provide grid stability and look to essentially provide greater times of diesels off where they don't have to have their generators running in times of where there's low hydro flow, but also using the excess energy that's provided by that hydrogen or by the hydro facility to power that battery. So it's as a matter of fact, too, that the project, given that it is a hydrogen battery and used for these purposes, it would be kind of a proof of concept for the application of that in rural Alaska. Is that something that hasn't been done before? That's something that we're looking forward to and looking forward to working with the community on. The fourth item would be a pending application with the Old Harbor Native Corporation. They were a recipient of a large federal grant under the prior administration that was paused, but ultimately the monies there have been freed up for that program. But they're looking to install a hydroelectric facility on their it's going to be a run-of-river facility. But the source of the hydro is the same that they use for their drinking water. Not to say that would be negatively impacted, but it's just kind of a creative agreement. The incumbent utility there is AVEC, so that'd be structured under a power purchase agreement with AVEC. Currently, they estimate the project cost to be about $36 million. Of which they have a portion of that secured, but they're exploring kind of options in terms of how they're going to meet those financing needs. 4.9 of which is expected to come from the Power Project Fund, and then the remainder would be funded most likely through our sister agency ADA for probably a loan amount of $20 million, which would be secured via investment tax credits that are proposed to be available for that project. And we don't deem that to be a risk. If it were wind or solar, then that would be one thing. But hydro, fortunately, is not subject to those early or the advanced deadlines. So that's something again that we're looking forward to working with the community on. And if those two go through, then that will effectively tap out our available funding under the program. We've got about $10 million that comes in. We'll be just shy. So obviously we'd have the opportunity to finance some smaller projects, like $100,000 or so, but we'd be looking to at options to replenish that fund at that point. Oh, sorry. And the city of Atka, there was a late loan payment. And this is not something that's been recurring for the city of Atka. Generally, been a good borrower under their prevailing loan. We just had some issues reaching the community. They're on a semi-annual basis, so they only make two payments a year, but generally on time. But we just had some difficulty in reaching the community. But we just received word yesterday from the community that they were going to rectify the late loan payment immediately. And actually, as of 20 minutes ago, I got an email, and we've already received payment for that. So we're all set on that one. So glad to see that was able to come through. And also like to commend Loan Servicing for their diligence in that matter.
I think the one last item is just a high level on the renewable energy, the REF program.
Fair enough. REF now in its 18th round, we went out for an RFA. We received about 35 applications as far as the stage one review. Two of those, um, I should say, two of those were rejected. One of them was purely just a duplicate submission. Another one was received late. It was a late submittal. So in fairness to the other applicants, it was rejected. So right now we're looking at 33 applications for a total loan request of about $54 million. And we're currently in stage two review, so that's economic and technical. We've got our third-party economists looking at the applications. We've got our internal staff looking at those as well, conducting reviews. And then from that, we'll go to stage three, which looks at ranking that considers cost of energy and other factors that are more structured, and I should say less subjective. And then stage four, obviously, is going to be meeting with the REFAC and going over our list of recommended projects. And then we're still on track to have a timely submittal to the legislature regarding that list and then the project status update.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions, comments, board, on the net metering pilot program, power project fund update, or the renewable energy grant fund update? Yes. Okay. Jeff.
Sorry if I'm the one asking questions today, but I've been reading this and looking over. First question is on the net metering program. In the analysis, did we look over what other states were doing? Question one, and you know how their programs and their net metering that may tailor to Alaska's. And then, can you give me for the public's interest? It seems like you said there was a little, or in the report, not necessarily written by you, but said that there was little participation. I was just curious as to any thoughts on that.
I'll start with your first question. And yes, there was consideration in terms of what was going on. I will say that this was, as stated in the memo, this was an initiative that was sought to be pursued by the governor and given ultimately assigned to AEA to carry out. So in full disclosure, you know, we were working in coordination with some of the utilities in the development of the program, but ultimately, you know, had to meet the needs of what the priorities of the governor's office were. There were some issues that were brought up, but ultimately the program was carried out as it currently stands, and the lack of participation, I won't really make a comment on that. I'd leave that to the utilities to comment on. But in speaking with them, for some of the reasons that were stated in the memo are largely kind of the hesitancy on the part of the utilities to participate. The first of which would being the administrative burden, since the collection of the costs that would come along with administering a program such as this are not recoverable by the utilities through funds made available under the program. So they had to be incorporated as a part of the rate base. Secondly, that there was some concern that if the program were to be carried out as soon as the funds were exhausted from the program, that the consumers that would be participating and receiving that subsidized rate would ultimately make would be concerned that rate falling off, and then the utilities may feel some degree of obligation to continue that, and that would come at a potentially significant cost to the utility. And create some exacerbate some of the issues that are currently present in some of that occurred part of some of the net metering programs that are currently operating, and thirdly, as in terms of just the long term impact, they thought the idea was that perhaps it'd be wiser to do it as part of a CapEx offset versus kind of a short-term increased or subsidized rate for net metering participants. The idea is not to have folks that already have systems to necessarily overbuild those systems to capitalize on capitalize on a short-term rate, but also in terms of making those systems accessible to kind of all community members, helping the idea is that having a financial offset to that initial high capital cost would be more beneficial than, say, just having a short-term subsidized rate, in the sense that that is not only is it short-term in nature, but also that the high capital cost is definitely one of the hurdles that a lot of folks have in addressing some of those desires to install those net meter installations on their residences.
Thank you.
Mr. Rizzo?
Yeah, I think I can maybe add to the, you know, for the sake of transparency and for public information as a utility, I can only speak for Matanuska Electric, and so I'll put that hat on for a minute and say we're interested in the program. We've seen quite a bit of growth in net metering overall. Net metering is a program by which homeowner, residence, business, primarily solar. We're not, I would say 99% of what we're seeing in the valley is solar, rooftop solar installations. These installations, when they're generating their own power based on decades-old rate-making constructs that I would love to see changed, when they're generating power for themselves, they're not contributing to the overall system on a per kilowatt hour basis. So what does that mean? It means there's a subsidy because we're not-for-profit cooperatives. My own utility, that subsidy, a couple years ago we did the analysis, is about $54 per month. Now some is less, some is more. What does that mean? That while someone is someone who's connected to the system, but in, especially in the summer months, which is our lowest demand, I wish it was our highest. We don't really have air conditioning load. Our peak follows the temperatures as they go down. Our demand goes up. They generate that solar. They might actually get a credit because they overgenerate. It goes into the system, so they get a credit from the utility. But in that per kilowatt hour, on a per kilowatt hour basis, they're not contributing to the system that they're connected to. That means, and for us, it's over $300,000 a year that every other member is paying more to cover net metering installations. Program like this is intended for the purposes, as Connor outlined, I think you did a great job because I was in some of those discussions, is to offset that subsidy to see what would happen. I mean, I'm just really oversimplifying this. So through this program, if the utility recovers that subsidy, you know, how would that impact, say, the growth or usage, et cetera? And there are just a variety of questions. I think you've got a great outline here, but I'll just add to them. There is an RCA open docket looking at net metering and expanding it up to, say, 20%. Railbelt utilities were about 5% is what, you know, we have to file with the commission. The minimum standard is 1.5%. That's what we have to do of our overall annual demand. And so we're seeing growth in the program. The RCA has an open docket. There's legislation looking at doing this. And there's this program, which there's the administrative burden of how do we keep track of those that were being reimbursed for the subsidy. But what if that funding were to just say go away after next November or, you know, a year from January if there's a change and it's not funded? Well, now all of a sudden that subsidy has gone up substantially, and it puts a not-for-profit cooperative in a position of having to potentially tell all of those members, sorry, now we're going to, you know, you're not in that program anymore. We're taking it away because it's not funded. So there are just other attributes to it that we're working through, and I'm confident that we'll make this work.
Well, and not to editorialize, but that's kind of the purpose of a pilot program is to test the waters and see what would work and what wouldn't and how to structure it for a real program. So any other questions on the planning reports? Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah, I want to move over to the power. I want to get it right, the power project funds. The applications pending, you have three of them. What is the timeline for those? And I'm equally agnostic on all of them, but I do know that Old Harbor has a FERC deadline.
And so FERC, unlike wind and solar, imposes you must be in construction by, and it's not by moving a shovel out there. You actually have to be working on one of the project works. So they have a very onerous notice to proceed. One of those requirements before you can get the notice to proceed is to show FERC that you have thorough funding to not only start the project but to complete it. And so therefore they have this burden on them. I do know that they are riding that near the end of life where if you don't get to a certain midnight, you know, the Cinderella carriage turns into a pumpkin. So my board hat saying, you know, what can we do to make sure that we can facilitate Old Harbor only because they're in that window. Now, I will say for my knowledge is that our congressional delegation, all three of them underneath a House bill or a Senate bill, has asked the FERC Cinderella list that's currently out there, and I'm not saying just Alaska, but nationwide, is being extended because of all these projects were involved with the COVID hiatus where you couldn't get contractors to work on the project, you couldn't get people to fly, and so there's extenuating circumstances. But Congress hasn't passed that bill yet. So I don't know, you know, I want to be fair to all. I'm just adding that I know Old Harbor needs some timeliness.
You know, this is Curtis. I can answer that question. They have to file an application before we can consider it. So the timing really falls to them, and we do have a limited amount of money. Now, anything from, you know, $1 to $2 million is approved by the loan committee, and then anything from $2 to $5 million goes approved by the loan committee and given to the board to approve. Anything over five goes to the legislature. That's probably why you see $4.9 million. But if they were to apply tomorrow, we would start working on that application and work it through the process. And if we need to, we'll call subject to the call of the chair, a meeting to approve it or disapprove it or at least discuss it. But again, they have to, and it's first come, first serve. If we have somebody that comes in and applies, they could be out, you know, in the sense of our funds are limited in that sense, too. So we just need to see an application. And then once we have reviewed an application, we set that money aside until they move forward, you know, while we move through the process. So, you know, and I was not in the meeting with Old Harbor to understand how soon they might apply, or are they just fishing for opportunities, you know, different pools of money. I don't know.
I want to say, oh, go on.
This is Connor. I can add to that a little bit, but thank you, Curtis, for that information. The native village of ECA had stated that they were going to submit an application sometime here in October, although given the current date of the 30th, I anticipate that has been delayed somewhat. So, but I would expect that the application would be received sometime kind of here in the fourth quarter. But the timing on that one is somewhat undetermined, as well as with the Old Harbor one, although, they do have outside consultants, you know, looking to kind of, help, finalize their overall capital stack. And when I spoke to Ada, some time ago, they had not yet been approached, on their portion. So that may be that they're exploring other options, and I don't know if Ada is more of a lender of last resort at this point. But, you know, clearly, the capitalization of the PPF fund and given the hurdles for the legislative portion in excess of $5 million, is something that Old Harbor is looking to, looking to avoid, for not to cause undue delay for project financing.
Well, I just want to say thank you both to you and the executive director for clarifying that. I didn't realize, quote, I should have understood application pending means they haven't actually turned it in. I was misunderstanding that there was an application already in the works, so to say, or in the hopper. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, board? Okay, Director Thayer.
All right. The last item that we have, and I understand that we need to be respectful of time because we do have an executive session and a lot of information to cover. And that is Karen Bell for the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, which I will say that Mark and Bill and Karen and Tony, we have been living and breathing this for over a year now.
Good morning. I'm Karen Bell. I'm AEA's RTO program manager. Since the last board meeting in July, the RCA has suspended the RTO's initial OAT filing of the open access transmission tariff in August and invited interested parties to intervene. Currently, there are 15 parties in the matter, so it's a big group of people, and the matter is moving along quite quickly on a rapid timeline. The RTO had 5 witnesses submit testimony to support the tariff. There's been reply testimony from 5 entities that were intervening. In February, there is a three-week hearing that's scheduled. If needed, it may be shorter than that. And then the final decision is due by June 4th from the RCA. Are there any questions? Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Rizzo.
Yeah, more of a comment. I wouldn't want to ask a question. It's an open docket, and I'm not going to attempt to speak to a matter that's before the RCA. So what I'd like to add maybe is for context that the idea of the Railroad Transmission Organization is based on, I believe, a very urgent need to centralize key functions of railroad utilities that have grown up over time and now are, you know, right up against each other. And the concept of a generation and transmission entity that took care of and was focused on things like transmission, it's referred to as backbone legislation, so that rather than an individual entity prioritizing key backbone transmission at, say, a high level or a low level, it might be different based on their own needs and budgetary limitations. Having a function like this grow in the future, I would certainly support, because I think it would benefit consumers. And the analysis shows that economic dispatch could be conducted with the addition of transmission, not only SIPLink, but to extend that up to Healy so you have 2 transmission paths serving 75-80% of the population could result in economic dispatch, which would reduce overall fuel cost estimated in the 10-15% area. The total of about $2 billion was estimated to complete all of these things. SIPLink is part of that. The transmission all the way up to Healy would be part of that. And it's clear that the benefit to the consumer in the future and the ability to bring on large loads like data centers would benefit from these kinds of structures. I really appreciate, Karen, your efforts and AEA's leadership in what I think is just the beginning of something that's going to benefit power consumers greatly in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Last, but we do have Leonard Robertson with IT. We're doing a lot of IT switching over, and then he can explain why nobody had access to their accounts yesterday. it was really special when I was getting on the airplane and I had no boarding pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify my comment. It was not meant to be personal. It was just to introduce some levity to the
I believe Curtis would like to refer to me as the agent of chaos, not agent of change for organizations. And actually this organization, AEA and AIDA, has been actually quite a pleasure. The staff has been very adaptable. In your packet, you'll receive some of these updates in a written form. But what I want to say is typically when you're going through change management, especially major change, you'll have a crawl, walk, run. And a good deal of the time, the staff here have embraced fast walking on multiple platforms. And the IT team has been doing a lot of running. And so some of that is coming due to When I arrived, everybody recognized they wanted a change, an upgrade, and what we identified as priorities, what we saw as possibly risks physically or redundancy-wise, not necessarily cyber-wise, that we were going to prioritize. And so we were able to, I got to put my glasses on, hope you guys can appreciate that. So we were able to, one, go from a risk state of SharePoint Exchange being on-premise to where we started embracing software as a service. We've moved those to the cloud. We are also right now going through a phone system upgrade and a network upgrade, and we've signed the contract under ADA as the landlord for the building to upgrade all of the switching gear so we can do a phone upgrade that helps to further bifurcate the two agencies. Another side part of this is that everything we're doing is attempting to clearly bifurcate IT costs and IT operations for both organizations, which gives a nice financial picture where you're using standardization across that process to save money on support, but it does at least have one of my favorite things, it segments those operations, which is really good for security. So all of the major systems that both organizations have been using was we managed to use the spring event of the volcano as a catalyst to move all of our systems to the cloud. And so we did a rapid lift and shift. Really happy with that, how that project went. So we don't have a physical problem where everything is all of our eggs in one basket. So there's a lot more resilience across the organization at this time. Another part of just speaking to you is the way and approach that we're doing this is I try to keep cybersecurity somewhat simple. I did work in a cybersecurity role previously, and as those that are UN FERC and NERC land and understand the thousands of 853 controls that you have to stick to, I like four controls. I wanted to speak to that to the board. These four controls, historically, I call it the Ohio 4/Australia 4 based upon their different directorates. And it has shown keeping it simple, it's easy for executives. I know you guys are a lot more complicated in this realm than most. But multi-factor authentication, the lift that we've done this year has allowed us to start to get multi-factor affordable across our different applications and platforms and to enable each one of these individuals behind me to be more secure and keep their data private and appropriate for public disclosure. Cybersecurity training, we work with the state security office. We embrace that and go through regular training just like every other state employee. Network risk segmentation, what we're doing is we're segmenting AA to an AEA operation from each other, but also making sure, just like in the different organizations, that we are separating our SCADA controls from our regular networking controls and even our phone controls separate from our network. So a lot of really fun work that is invisible to the team here, but they have been very supportive during the change management. And then endpoint hardening. These new tools are also allowing us to get down and to start setting some standards across the equipment that we did not have an efficient process to do that. So very appreciative to the different companies that have supported us. Microsoft's been great throughout this process with us and helping us to go to the M365 platform and to totally get quite a bit done this year. So thank you also to OIT and Microsoft.
Just a quick question. On the OT environment, like SCADA systems, are those like AEA control systems for utilities? Or?
That's outside of the realm that with which the IT team typically, we might consult or can work with, but what we're speaking about at least is building controls for this particular facility.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, made a leap in the wrong direction there. Any questions, board? Okay, thank you.
All right, the next couple of items is we have community outreach, which is in your board packet. Again, date, role, description, and location, and what type of outreach that we're doing. In addition to that, we have the articles of interest. Again, you can read at your perusal. Again, if it's something where AEA is mentioned in an article, a major article or something, I do send that to the board in advance just so you can get it in real time. And then the next item is our next regularly scheduled AEA board meeting. Subject to the board's decision is January 29th at 9 a.m. in a place to be determined, because it might be good if we do a a board retreat, we go to the Megan Room or someplace maybe off-site a little bit to do that. And then the next item that we do have is executive session. Just because of looking at the clock, I do not mind if everybody stays in the room for Section 1, which is an overview of our budget submittal, and number 2. But when we start going into owned assets, which is number 3, I'd like everybody to leave the room with the exception of Mark and the owned assets team.
Okay, so with that, I'll entertain a motion to go into executive session, but then I'll suggest an executive session after the first two items. Maybe we'll just take a quick five-minute recess while we clear the room. So.
Sure, and I'm going to modify a little bit. I move that the board enter into an executive session to discuss confidential, one, financial matters related to fiscal year 27 budget, two, attorney-client communications, three, information related to AEA strategic planning, and four, personnel matters, five, IRC section 6417 direct pay provisions for Bradley expansion. This is supported by the Open Meetings Act, AS 44.62.310, which allows the board to consider confidential matters in executive session. In this case, the board believes that these are subjects which would have an adverse effect on finances of AEA or protected by law due to rules protecting personal privacy and certain business information and deliberative process. No action will be taken in executive session. Action may occur after closure of executive session.
Okay. Could you repeat item 5, please?
Item 5 is Internal Revenue Code, or IRC, section 6417, direct pay provisions for Bradley expansion. And I have that written down here. So
do you have a motion?
This is Clawell and Smythe. I'll second.
Have a motion and a second. A discussion? Okay. Roll call vote.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Smythe?
Yes.
Mr. Mathiason?
Yes.
Mr. Seidman is absent. Mr. Izzo?
Yes.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Copeland?
Yes.
The motion carries, Chair, and we will go off the record.
I wanted to talk to the chair before. We didn't get a chance to do so. And
No,
we're still in executive session.
Don't forget to get Jenna for your executive session materials, and I signed those two solutions for you.
These are mine, but
yeah, I'm just going to
read you. Oh, you can use it. I got you.
You're back on the record.
Okay, thank you. The board is out of executive session now, and I advise that the board has not taken any formal action on the matters discussed while in executive session. That, I think we have one remaining motion.
Board comments, if you want.
Oh, board comments.
I'm just going to make a quick board comment because I know my chair needs to get out of here. Great meeting. Thank you very much. Staff was well prepared. I wish our auditors, their PowerPoint was working, but we got the data crossed and, you know, we made it work. So good meeting. Thank you.
And if I could just say, I just want to thank the staff, especially, you know, you had all the directors here. I think it's important to have the directors here, but also the people that work for them to understand the board and the process, because this is a new day for the board and a new day for the employees of how the board interacts. And so we really appreciate that. But the reason the team isn't back is they're actually meeting with DOE right now. They had a noon call on a potential opportunity dealing with owned assets. So that's where that team is. So, again, thank you for everybody, and I want to thank Jennifer and especially Mark because, like I said, we weren't sure at one time if we needed a general counsel. Mark has found we probably need him plus others. Mark's doing a great job for us across the spectrum, and I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah, good meeting, lots of information. Interesting to see how it fits together, and I'm looking forward to strategic planning. So, all right, we are adjourned. Okay. Thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you, guys.